I'm a little bit of a time Nazi, actually. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say time Nazi on the podcast. I'm pretty sure I've said significantly worse over the last few years. But I know a lot of you listening to this podcast, you would love to get an hour or two back every day to get more work done, get your training sessions in, or like just even spend time with family or loved ones. And meal prep is something that a lot of people struggle with when it comes to time. So today's episode of the podcast is brought to you by Clean Cut Meals, Ireland's number one meal prep company. Clean Cut Meals plans are carefully chosen to help you meet your health and fitness goals without the stress of shopping, prepping, cooking, and cleaning. You can rest easy knowing that each week you'll be receiving tasty, nutritious meals designed to keep you fit, fueled, and motivated, delivered directly to your door no matter where you are in the country. Meal prep, never boring, with over 30 different delicious meals to choose from. Set yourself up for success, whatever success looks like for you, whether your goals are weight loss, building muscle, or simply saving yourself some time, Clean Cut Meals has the perfect plan for you. You'll be familiar with Clean Cut Meals because they're the company that I use anytime I am struggling for time, either with commitments, not so much during COVID, but with commitments to speaking engagements and where I'm training for races. This is the company that I use, so I can speak from first-hand experience that they're awesome. Order online today at cleancutmeals.ie and use coupon code BrianK20 for 20% off your very first order. Eat well, look good, feel great. Check that code out. Again, that's BrianK20 for 20% off, cleancutmeals.ie. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm your host, Brian Keane, best-selling author of the book, The Fitness Mindset and Rewire Your Mindset, here to help you by deconstructing expert guests on all things health, fitness, and mindset. Today's guest is nutritionist Isabella Robinson. Isabella is an expert in all things to do with disordered eating, and we go deep today on things like managing disordered eating, the problem with diet culture, and handling food addiction. So if you're someone that falls on that spectrum where you'd like to improve your relationship with food, where you struggle with the intuitive side of eating, where you'd like to honor your hunger a little bit better and not constantly be falling into the different diet culture, whether that be calorie counting, whether that be Slimming World, Weight Watchers, or anything in between, even up to the scale to keto and vegan, which is probably even more sustainable than the previous two I mentioned. We talk about the misinformation online and the problem with diet culture. We talk about what to do if you're addicted to food. Very interesting and a very useful part of this podcast that we haven't previously covered. And Isabella is somebody that I wanted to talk to on this because this is her area of expertise. So if you feel that you're addicted to chocolate or you feel that you're addicted to certain foods, that might be a very, very useful section of today's podcast. We talk about how to honor your hunger and the pros of intuitive eating and some of the misconceptions around it. The question is to ask yourself if you feel guilt around food. So managing those emotions, guilt, shame, that you might have anxiety when it comes to food, how to become more connected with the eating experience, and the difference between eating disorder and disordered eating and where the spectrum falls. So we go deep in today's episode. I love this conversation. There's so much value in here. If you are somebody that is looking to improve that relationship with food or just become a little bit more intuitive with your actual eating, this is an absolute must listen. So without further ado, here is today's episode with nutritionist Isa Robinson on food addiction, disordered eating, and the problem with diet culture. Enjoy. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm delighted to be joined today with my guest, Isabella Robinson. Isabella is a registered associate nutritionist, certified intuitive eating counselor, and qualified nutritional therapist with a special interest in disordered eating, food anxieties, body image, and nutrition for mental health. She is passionate about helping clients rediscover confidence and trust in nourishing their bodies so they can free up space for what really matters. I'm really looking forward to talking all things food freedom, nutrition, and diet culture in today's episode. Isabella, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Brian. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast. I'm super excited for this conversation.
Oh, the pleasure's all mine. As I said to you just before we went on air, I've been following your Instagram page for ages. I love your message when it comes to nutrition and kind of putting it across, the way you put it across for people. So before we dive into all things diet culture, nutrition in general, tell us a little bit about your backstory and what got you interested in food in the first place.
Yeah, thank you so much, Brian. It feels like it's been a long journey and I'm still relatively early on. This is just my second year of working one-to-one with my clients and in private practice, but it feels like there's already so much kind of history there. So it actually didn't all start off wholly positively. When I was a younger teenager, I very much was influenced and fell victim to a lot of the misinformation available, not even on social media then, because I think all we had was Facebook. So there was no Instagram, no TikTok, nothing like that. And I was also reading a lot of glossy magazines, and I formed a very unhealthy relationship with food. And it was a really challenging time through school and into early university. And I then stumbled across sort of the rise of wellness in the UK. And I'm always really careful when I speak about this, because I think the sort of dawn of wellness in the UK impacted people differently. And I'm always cautious now about thinking critically about what we mean by wellness, what we mean by health, and what might be lurking underneath that that might be helpful and what might be really harmful. Anyway, around this time, I was really wanting to kind of learn how to look after myself much better. And I became quite interested in nutrition. And I actually set up almost like a wellness blogging Instagram account, where I shared, you know, a lot of nice smoothies and things that I was eating and things that I was doing, like yoga and all sorts of things like that. And after a little while, I started to kind of interact with different people, and I began to see that maybe this wasn't so much about health. And I actually felt like a bit of a hypocrite. You know, I was at uni at the time, and I was having an awesome uni experience. And anyone who's at uni at the moment or kind of looks back on their uni times, I'm sure you're not thinking of kale and smoothies. I'm thinking more about Domino's pizza and you know, a lot of late nights. And I felt like I was almost living this double life. I was under this wellness blogger name, and I was interested in salads and porridge, but I was also going out with my friends and, you know, drinking and eating pizza at ridiculous hours of the night. And I began to get really conflicted about it, but I also was really enjoying all of it. And that felt like a really good balance. So following this, I actually wrote my undergraduate dissertation on the rise of the Eat Clean movement and how that can operate as a guise for disordered eating and eating disorders. And then after university, I decided that I really wanted to understand the nutrition information for myself, that I didn't just want to believe what I was reading in headline articles and from my favorite blogger or this, that, and the other. I really wanted to be informed from the literature and the science and to be qualified and perhaps supporting people going through their own journeys myself. So I did a year of biomedicine and I did my nutritional therapy course, and then I did my master's in eating disorders and clinical nutrition at UCL, which I finished last year. And I'm now working in private practice, specializing in something called intuitive eating, which I'm sure we'll come on to discuss. So yeah, I'm sure you regret asking that now, but it's been a long journey, and it didn't all start out wholly positive, but I'm really grateful for what I've learned and to be able to go back and study it and have an opportunity to get really stuck into the literature and be able to think more critically about what we might read online.
Yeah, I love that. I'm going to double back with the disordered eating, and because I know that's an area you definitely specialize in and put out great information on it. But I'm curious, just before we do that, you talked about the misinformation that you came across when you were on the journey of, you know, becoming qualified and learning more about nutrition. What do you generally see now, Isabella, that's the biggest misinformation that's out there? Or is there any one or two trends that you see that kind of irk you a little bit, or that are just plain misinformation when it comes to people's nutrition or diets in general?
Oh, Brian, there are so many. And you know what's so funny is that I get such like ick that I've even politely had to sort of, I overheard things in coffee shops, you know, whilst you're queuing up pre kind of COVID and lockdown, and actually had to say, I'm really sorry, can I just politely interrupt you and say that that's not true? We'll just really think, oh my goodness, what is she doing? But there's loads, and I think...
Oh, give me an example of that for sure. Does any come to mind to when that would have happened?
So I had somebody in a coffee shop saying, did you know that a potato is basically sugar? that basically it's just a load of sugar. And I think where I'm going to just backtrack, because I'll explain that, is that some of these things are grounded in some element of science. So let's take the potato as sugar. A potato is a starchy carbohydrate. It will also contain, as all foods do, like a tiny little bit of everything. So it will contain a tiny little bit of protein and a tiny bit of fat as well. But we mainly think of it as a starchy carb. When you digest, it will also have a lot of vitamins and minerals in and other things. So just a caveat. When you digest a carbohydrate, your body digests it usually primarily into glucose. And we often think of glucose as sugar. So yes, there's a tiny bit of science in there. However, the glucose in a potato is something that we refer to as non-free sugar. Now, what we mean by that is that the glucose in the potato is contained within the cell wall. So it's contained within the cell structure of the wall. And that means there's a much slower release of that glucose into the bloodstream. So we might think of it more as a complex carbohydrate. So we're going to get that slower release of energy. We're also going to get the other nutrients, etc., which is very, very different to if you swallow a tablespoon of sugar. Now, governments, new strategies, X, Y, and Z. I've got a lot to say on that if you'd like to listen. You know, they're talking about, you know, we need to reduce our sugar. We need to reduce our sugar. And do you know what? You know, for anything, if we're talking about any food in excess, is never going to be a good thing. Even things like kale. I've been doing a lot of talks in schools at the moment. And, you know, if you eat kale in excess, and I'm talking about buckets and buckets and buckets of kale, it contains a compound in it called goitrogens, and goitrogens can prevent the absorption of iodine, which is a mineral, from going into the thyroid, and the thyroid gland controls things like metabolism. So anything in immense excess is never going to be a good thing. Back to the potato. Very different to a tablespoon of caster sugar. And I think, you know, when the government's talking about sugar, they're never ever talking about these non-free sugars. What we mean by non-free sugars, the sugars not within the cell wall structure. And therefore, when we're talking about things like fruits, vegetables, whole grains, you know, we never need to be worried about the sugar in those foods. So that's one of the misconceptions that I see, and something that I just wanted to interrupt, because, you know, the glucose in the potato, that's carbohydrate, which our body loves. It's our body's preferred source of fuel, and very, very different, say, a tablespoon of caster sugar or the type of sugar that this person was kind of comparing it to.
Just to stay on that a second, and then I'm definitely going to ask about some other misconceptions because I'm curious. But to stay on that, why, as sometimes one of the conversations I have with one of my best friends who's a nutritionist as well is, you know, the curse of knowledge, that you forget that because you know something and it's so obvious to you, in that case, that somebody would say, you know, potatoes basically all sugar would be so obviously untrue. But for some people, that's their reality. That's their truth. That's what they believe. Where do you think that misinformation is coming from, either in that example or across the board in general? Or have you thought about this in terms of why people have such a massive amount of misinformation or misconceptions when it comes to their food?
Yeah, thank you so much for that question, Brian. And I just want to echo you there, that I have fell victim to all of these things. And I think it's definitely not to make fun of anyone or make anyone feel silly, that we are bombarded by all this information, and that it's important that we are gentle on ourselves as we move through perhaps unlearning or relearning. So I just wanted to say, I think that's such a brilliant point that you brought up. I had just onto the other point that you made about where is all this coming from? And I think, you know, nutrition information and those who can call themselves a nutrition professional is totally unregulated. Anyone can do an online course and technically call themselves a nutrition expert. So it is quite a scary place out there and an unregulated space, especially on social media. And I think we see really sort of strong ideologies coming through, that we're no longer just talking about food or science. We're really talking about belief systems and all sorts of, you know, really extreme views. And, you know, I think the food industry, and I've read this a little bit, and I don't think the food industry is all bad whatsoever. But I was reading something the other day that they sort of profit in some ways from all of this conflicting information that is out there, because we all remain slightly confused and not sure what the best thing is for us. And the truth is, the best thing for us is probably different for every single one of us. The other thing is that when we see headlines like Daily Mail, God forbid, we don't know what kind of evidence they're talking about. You know, are they getting this headline from a study that was literally done on 40 lab rats? Or was it done in vitro, which means they isolate organs or tissues to perform scientific studies on and then extrapolate that to something like, you know, this food makes you live longer. A really good example, actually, is intermittent fasting. There are so many headlines on intermittent fasting. You know, it is the cure to all of our problems. It will help you live far longer. It prevents X, Y, and Z disease. When actually the large majority of research in intermittent fasting is in rats, fruit flies, and worms. And we have so few on humans. I think potentially one or two. And I think this really starts to get at just how we're jumping from a study that's done in lab rats to something like intermittent fasting, which is now being done by lots of people, when we actually have no strong concrete evidence that that's sort of the best practice for human beings.
Yeah, it's that headline is there's, and again, I've been drawn in myself, not so much now because you're able to look at things with a critical eye, but definitely when you're being bombarded with things like, I've had that conversation about intermittent fasting with so many people about the, you know, it'll make me live longer. I'm like, I was like, you're not a rat though. I'm like, yeah. I was like, I could confidently say yes if you were a rat, but I'm like, you're not. So I'm like, you might, it could work amazingly well, but I can't say it with any kind of concrete belief that yes, you will definitely live longer if you do intermittent fasting. Do you have any, I know you're a big fan of intuitive eating and we're going to come back to that for sure, but is there any other diets out there that you see that aren't particularly useful for the majority of people, or even when it comes to the people you're working with, do a lot of them come in with their own misconceptions around diet, or are they coming off the back of Slimming World or Weight Watchers or keto diet, or what are the kind of people you're working with, Isabella, and what kind of pre or misconceptions do they have before they come to you that you try and put in plan in place around?
Yeah, thank you so much, Brian, and such a great question. And I think, you know, I actually tend to see all sorts of things, from Slimming World to other types of just calorie controlled diets, etc. And I think certainly some of the ones you've mentioned, the ketogenic diet, I certainly wouldn't recommend for the large majority of the population, if anyone, except for perhaps if you're experiencing epilepsy. But I think there's something really sort of sly and sneaky, and that's how perhaps the type of person that I might have seen and what they present with has gone from, I'm on a concrete diet that I can label, such as I'm on, you know, Slimming World or I'm on the ketogenic diet, to, oh no, I don't diet. I'm not on a diet. And it's the way in which sort of being on a diet has morphed from a label to perhaps what we might think of as the diet mentality. And what I mean by the diet mentality is not being on a labeled diet, but perhaps being in the mind of a dieter. So what might that look like? Well, that might look like somebody that's just really interested in being healthy. Okay, no bad thing. But that means that there are good or bad foods. And perhaps when somebody has a bad food, they think, oh gosh, you know, I'm such a bad person. Or they ruminate and feel quite guilty or stressed about that. And we might argue that kind of these emotions of guilt or stress don't really have much of a place in kind of feeling healthy or optimal health. The other thing we might see is, oh gosh, I've had a bad food, so I've blown it, and so I might as well eat X, Y, and Z more, even though I'm kind of full, because today's ruined and I'll be good again tomorrow. So that's something else I see. It's almost like this sort of blown it mentality, or excuse me for swearing, but this almost like fuck it effect, where it's like, well, it's all out the window now, but don't worry, I'll be good tomorrow. The other thing we might see is people presenting with, I feel addicted to food. I'm addicted to chocolate or to sweets. And I'm always really cautious to make sure that we're always being so respectful of what somebody is experiencing. And that feeling of feeling addicted to that food is so, so real. But when we look at the evidence and kind of the studies on food addiction, we see a very different story. And again, a lot of evidence in rats and a lot of weird methodologies, which I can go into if that's something of interest. But what we tend to see is when a food is put off limits or restricted, that it almost goes on this pedestal. And, you know, we think of it as having this forbidden fruit effect. That as soon as you can't have that apple in the Garden of Eden, even though you can have all of these other things, that is the one that you're going to focus on and be obsessed with. And that is the feeling we get when we are not allowed something. And it's even more subtle, because I've had clients go, well, I'm eating this stuff, I'm not restricting it. But there can be psychological restriction. Well, what's going through your head as you're eating that food? Are you engaged with the joys of, I'm thinking about something delicious like a pan au chocolat and the flaky pastry on the outside and the doughiness on the inside and how that contrasts with the chocolate, and maybe you'd like that with a coffee or tea. You're not in that moment of joy. You are, oh my goodness, I shouldn't be having this. I'm a bad person. What if I feel like this later? Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And before you know it, there's almost this frantic rush to eat that food before you decide that you're not allowed it. So there's this disconnection from the eating experience. And I think that's what I tend to be seeing now more and more and more. Oh, I'm not on a diet. I have never dieted. And this is not to say anyone is a bad person, by the way. This is just kind of what we see in psychology. And again, I'll put my hands up and be the first to say that I've absolutely been there and been there with the best intentions for my well-being. But we see this stuff backfiring. And you know what the worst part is? We completely blame ourselves. Oh, I can't, there's something wrong with me. I lack willpower. I just have all these thoughts about food and I can't get rid of them. When really what we're seeing is the reinvention of what used to be Slimming World or Atkins or whatever it is, the reinvention of this as something that we can't even label, operates ubiquitously amongst all of us. And, you know, I think that's the scary thing. And I call it the diet mentality, because I think that that's kind of the best way to label it. And that's what they label it in intuitive eating, which is the framework I use. So yeah, that's what I'm seeing now more and more.
I'm going to take one step back for two steps forward on this one, because I definitely want to come back to intuitive eating and around a little bit around the disordered eating as well. But just because something I haven't covered previously on the podcast, and I'd love to get your take on this, because I think you put this across so well on your Instagram page about people that are addicted to food. And I'm also hesitant to ask a question that needs a probably contextual answer to the individual, but I'm going to ask for kind of a best practice. If someone come to you, Isabella, and they say, I'm addicted to chocolate, or I'm addicted to insert food here, what would be the kind of best practices or steps, or even the step one, that you would get them to check in with in terms of either their mindset or something practical with their nutrition when somebody comes to you and says, look, I'm addicted to this food here? What would be your kind of follow-up on that?
Yeah. And Brian, it's so hard, and I'm so cautious not to give out sort of really personalized advice, you know, when I don't have a case history and all of those kinds of things, just because we'd be potentially doing someone a disservice. But I'd be really interested in, first of all, finding out, well, what's their eating like in the day? You know, have they, you know, skipped breakfast and lunch and then they feel addicted to chocolate in the afternoon? Or perhaps it's a bit more subtle than that, but meals are small and somebody's getting hungry. Do they allow themselves that food often? How does it make up their day? What perhaps is the inner monologue like as they are eating that food? What are their beliefs about that food? It might also be important to understand perhaps emotional states around these kinds of eating. So, you know, is there high stress? is there perhaps a tendency to feel quite anxious, all of these kinds of things. And then I guess it would be a slow process of thinking, is somebody eating enough and consistently and regularly throughout the day? Do they trust, and not just them, but have their cells come to trust that they can have that food and it's available? And can they enjoy that experience of being connected with the food without the food police, that voice in their head suddenly coming up to say, oh my goodness, you bad person, you've had this food. So we might think about doing that. But I'd say the real first step is somebody having adequate nourishment to meet their needs? And are they having the food regularly and enjoying it and feeling mindful in that process of eating it, so connected to the taste, the textures, the aromas, because usually that's what's going to help the cells trust that they can have it. And once we know we can have something, it's really not that exciting. You know, they've done studies, this is one of my favorites, but they've done studies with kids. And they've said to the kids, they've given them access to M&Ms. They can have as many as they want, you know, go crazy on the M&Ms. They said, just don't eat the red ones. Guess what color all of these kids fixated on? They could have as many M&Ms as they wanted, but they all wanted the red ones. So once we start bringing something down from that pedestal, once our cells trust, don't worry, this food is going to be available when we feel like it and our bodies are well nourished, they're not primarily hungry, then that's probably going to be helpful for starting to feel more in control and more empowered around that food so that we can just move on with our day and enjoy it as part of that varied and balanced lifestyle.
I love that in terms they don't put food on a pedestal. One of the things that I've said on this podcast in the past is that stop separating food into good and bad categories. I'm like, food has no morals. Like, it's us that have given any sort of morality to the food. There are no good or bad food. Context matters. But I love that. Don't put it on top of a pedestal, because instantly that's what you're going to want. You talk about the disconnection from the eating experience, which I think ties beautifully into intuitive eating. What are the biggest misconceptions that people have when it comes to intuitive eating? I know I've had some of them in the past myself when I kind of went down the rabbit hole of, you know, reading books like Evelyn Tribal's book on intuitive eating. I had a couple of misconceptions, but what are the ones that you generally see when people think, okay, I'm going to try intuitive eating, but they're doing it the wrong way, or they have a preconceived idea of it that just is setting them up for failure nearly from the front end? What do you generally see, or if any, is it a common trend or is it different for everybody?
Yeah, and Brad, first of all, would it be helpful if I gave a little overview of what intuitive eating is and means?
Yes, please. That'd be great.
I know, I'm sure that your listeners will be quite tuned in, so I won't kind of go overboard. But I think there's already a misunderstanding in the name. And I see this come up quite a lot. So what is intuitive eating? Because it sounds like, oh, well, I just eat intuitively. I eat what I want, when I want, and, you know, it's amazing. And yeah, it is amazing. And it is about eating what you want, when you want. But I think it's about more than that too. And effectively, intuitive eating is a framework. And it's a self-care framework towards eating. So it's really grounded in self-care. And it's this dynamic interplay of thought, emotion, and instinct. So yes, intuition is part of it, but we are also integrating signals from the mind and the body and self-care and some aspects of rationality in all of that as well. And so I think that is really important. Now, there's 10 principles of intuitive eating. And it's evidence-based. So there are now over 125 studies to back intuitive eating up. It's not just this kind of willy-nilly thing. And I'll start with one of the big misconceptions is that, you know, you can just become an intuitive eater from one day to the next. You know, today I'm good foods and bad foods. Tomorrow I'm eating intuitively. And I think it's really important to say that intuitive eating or becoming an intuitive eater is a real process. And it's a real challenge. And it's about so much more, like I said, than that I'm just eating intuitively. Because one of the first things we have to do is reject the diet mentality. And that is kind of what we were talking about there, the good foods and bad foods and blown it effect and the pursuit of intentional weight loss. We have to sort of unlearn that. And in our culture, rich is just you know, seeping with diet culture. In fact, the co-author of Intuitive Eating, Evelyn Tribbley, says that diet culture is like water to a fish. It is literally all around us and we can't see it. And so that's a process in and of itself. And that can feel so challenging in our culture. A huge part of intuitive eating is also increasing interoceptive awareness. And what we mean by that is the awareness of an attunement to physical sensations that arise in the body. An obvious one might be sort of the sensation you get when you need to go to the bathroom. Brian, is that one that you could kind of think about and know, like you get that signal and you know what it means?
Yeah, 100%, thankfully.
I often talk about this with my clients and when I'm in schools, and I think, you know, when you get that signal, you don't cross your legs and think, oh my goodness, I am going to be so good today. I am going to be so disciplined and I'm going to demonstrate so much willpower and I am going to hold this pee in all day. No, you get the signal, you act on it. It's this magical thing where your body and your mind are kind of in this reciprocal, mutual, trusting relationship, and you go to the bathroom and you can move on with the rest of your day. Now, Brian, what happens, and I don't know if this has happened to you, but it certainly happened to me, and it's desperately uncomfortable, but when you get stuck really needing the loo when you're in a long car journey or commute.
Oh, it's a disaster. Like one of the worst things that can happen.
and how does it feel in your body?
It's the height of discomfort.
And can you just sit still and carry on reading a book or engaging in conversation?
No, you're thinking about nothing else. These are such great questions.
Yeah, and when you get to the bathroom, can you just slowly just like move there like nothing's happening?
It's the complete opposite. I won't go into detail, but no, it's all consuming in terms of I need to get this done.
Sorry. I hope your listeners don't mind me going into great detail about this. But that's the point. You know, when you're not acting on that signal, well, it just gets louder and more intense, and we're sort of shaking our legs and we can't focus on conversation because we just need the loo so much. Now, the same thing can kind of apply to food, that we might get signals from the body that communicate hunger. And those signals might communicate something like a gentle hunger, and then a bit more of an intense hunger, and then maybe primal hunger, which is that like insane levels of hunger that we might get where we just, you know, have to literally eat anything in sight. I don't know if anyone's listening has experienced that. So we're thinking about increasing interoceptive awareness in this process, which isn't just the awareness of these signals, but also acting on them in a timely manner and acting on them from a space of self-care. And then we've got all different kinds of other principles. You know, we think about the satisfaction factor and the joy of eating. We might be thinking about coping with emotions with kindness. So thinking about where emotions might come into play. There is joyful movement towards the end where we think about exercising for kind of joy and pleasure and fun, and how that might fit in with our lives, and gentle nutrition at the end. So it's so much more than just, oh, I fancy that biscuit, I'm going to eat it. It's such a sort of process, and it's a real process of unlearning, relearning, discovering, and ultimately working towards something that the co-authors Evelyn and Elise call authentic well-being. And I love this definition. And effectively, what it's about is taking what we know to be true as sort of objective scientific information, or the best science that we have right now, and blending that with what our body is communicating and what feels good in our bodies, in our lives, in our circumstances, and blending those so that that kind of authentic health is going to be so unique for us as individuals, rather than this one size fits all, you know, everyone do intermittent fasting or everyone cut this food group out. So it's really sort of unique and it's holistic. You know, it's really blending in all these different areas, which is why I think it's really powerful. So stop me if I'm going into things too much, but certain myths again that come to mind. So we've talked about, is it just eating what you want when you want? Yes, there is this wonderful part of intuitive eating, a whole principle on making peace with food. But we're also thinking about all of these other aspects that are less talked about, such as maybe honor your health with gentle nutrition, or hunger and fullness, or emotions. Does that feel good? Have you mindfully enjoyed that biscuit? Not that it's mindful eating. Intuitive eating and mindful eating are also very different. Mindful eating can be part of intuitive eating, but we think about intuitive eating as sort of this self-care framework, whereas mindful eating can be a bit more of a skill. And mindful eating can also be part of the diet mentality. It can be used as a diet tool. And that's where it's really important to distinguish. Another myth that comes up is that intuitive eating is the hunger and fullness diet. And again, it's really not the hunger and fullness diet. It's thinking about interoceptive awareness and attunement to those signals. But as we also said, it's this dynamic interplay of thought and rationality too. And, you know, I don't know about you, Brian, but I know when I have clients that sometimes I need to have an early lunch or something and I'm not necessarily hungry, but I'm sort of eating as an act of self-care because I don't want to be ravenous later on, or hungry in my session, or thinking about food in my session. Similarly, if you're sort of maybe going to be in a long car journey and you're not quite hungry yet, you might think, well, I'll have something just to tide me over. And then it's also not stop when you're full, that eating can also be about pleasure and about enjoyment. And certainly you might be feeling full, but if you want to partake in a slice of a friend's birthday cake, or, you know, something else along those lines, or you feel like you need something to just round off a meal for the satisfaction factor, that can also be part of intuitive eating. So many kind of myths that come up, and that's why often, and there are a lot of critics of intuitive eating. I think the sad thing is, as it's gaining popularity, which is amazing, a lot of it is being diluted. And what people take is snapshots like the hunger and fullness diet, or it's just eating what you want. And it's so, so much more nuanced. And I was going to use the word complex, but I like nuanced a bit more, and something that is more full bodied, and it's more of this kind of framework for living, and in a way that's taking care of ourselves and our needs and blending different things, than it is about just eat what you want. Although all foods fit with intuitive eating, which is also something that I love about it.
Yeah, I love that. I love, and that's how you promote your message as well. And that kind of comes through from your content, from your blog, from your Instagram. I have something that I want to ask there, because it jumped up as you were asking the questions about the when you have the urge to go to the bathroom. I think for everybody listening, there's so much value there in terms of if you're struggling in terms of, well, you know, how do you recognize when you feel hungry? It's like, because some people are very tuned into that. Other people, you know, Pavlovian response. I know myself, Pavlovian response. So I used to be a primary school teacher, so I still have a little bit of that 11 a.m. conditioning, 1 p.m. conditioning for food, because I was years in the school system where that was my break times. Do you think, or do you see, Isabella, do you see people confusing hunger with other things? Or what has been kind of your experience, even when in the process, even personally, what have you found has helped you to, for the lack of a better term, not confuse hunger with something else?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And I think often one of the key reasons we might be confused is because hunger has been something that has been so pathologized, that actually so much of diet culture or the diet mentality sort of encourages us to almost starve out our hunger or override it, or that, you know, hunger is negative because it means we're going to be taking on more food. And so this physical sensation vis-a-vis needing the loo has become very loaded and fraught with different emotions. And sort of every time we try to starve it out, or we try to sort of use some kind of beverage or coffee or something to kind of ride it out, our cells basically we're kind of building this distrust with our body, because our cells don't trust that food is kind of coming. And that's when they can intensify that hunger even more and potentially make us feel out of control and all those other things. So I think this demonization of hunger is really problematic, because we suddenly then, if we get that loss of control eating or that primal hunger, a bit like when we're so desperate for the bathroom, we're sort of shaking our legs, we come to see this as, oh my goodness, I can't be trusted. You know, my hunger is sort of wild and untamed and too much. Whereas actually, you know, if we're kind of trusting that signal and acting on it, we're going to be in a much kind of kinder relationships with ourselves and building that trust between, you know, our body and our mind, where, you know, your cells are saying, hi, food, please. And you're saying, yeah, here you go. So there's this trusting relationship. I also see all kinds of problematic messaging. You know, you might not be hungry, you're probably thirsty. And that's where I think, you know, would you ever mistake that signal for needing the bathroom for something a bit different? So all of these kinds of things, we can sometimes see emotions come up with eating experience. And I want to caveat by saying food is, you know, by default, an emotional experience. And there is nothing wrong with that. You know, we share food to show love. We see it kind of all of the time. Crying into ice cream after a breakup really comes to mind. And there is nothing wrong with using food for emotional purposes. That actually, in the grand scheme of things, that food is not the worst coping mechanism. And often what's so much worse is the way we self-flagellate and beat ourselves up for turning to food in times of need. And actually that can really be the most harmful part, rather than the food itself. When I would start to think that food might be problematic is when it really, really doesn't feel good because we feel kind of physically sick. And also when it's the only tool in our toolbox for managing different emotions or distress in our lives. And so often, rather than necessarily thinking about the food, it might be thinking about what kind of self-care tools do we have? What do we have in our lives for managing difficult situations and scenarios? And can we build up that toolbox and know that if food is part of that, that it is okay? And something I would add to that as well, and I'm sorry, Brian, I could talk for days about all this stuff, but this sense of that often when we are pretty hungry and then there is an emotional trigger, it's almost like what I would consider the perfect storm for what might feel like loss of control eating. And what that largely is our bodies being too hungry and something pulling the trigger of the gun to, you know, trigger that eating experience. But for the most part, it's our body being really smart. It's like, well, hello, I'm hungry. I need food. And often what we might think of as emotional eating might actually be hunger going on underneath. So what I might say is for anyone who thinks they might be experiencing a lot of emotional eating, to just zoom out a little bit to think, do I need some extra support? You know, do I want to reach out to my GP, to a psychologist, to a therapist, first of all? But also, am I eating enough throughout the day? Am I getting a balance of food and food groups? You know, am I making sure that eating it is satisfying? And is there just enough food? Because often it's a bit of biological hunger mixed with that emotional trigger that can really, as I said, create that perfect storm for what feels like emotional eating.
That's a great analogy, the one that I've used with clients. I think I'm going to use the perfect storm. I always think of like dynamite or TNT. I'm like, that's you undereating during the day, and an emotional trigger is someone setting the fuse. I'm like, it's just the perfect storm for things to go awry. But you've given me a perfect segue there to a question that I wanted to ask you since I started following your Instagram page, because you talk a lot about disordered eating. And again, I'm not going to put words in your mouth on this one. I don't want to lead the question, but I'm very curious because this is outside my area of expertise. So anything I offer on this is an opinion and anecdotal, but this is an area that you studied in very heavily when it comes to disordered eating. Do you find that emotional triggers or even emotions in general, like guilt or shame, do you find, or from your experience, I may be completely wrong, are they the root of a lot of disordered eating for people?
I think disordered eating, a bit like what we might think about as eating disorders, although it's important to make that distinction, is complex. And there will be many, many factors, from individual psychology, such as potentially individuals that might be more prone to perfectionism or anxiety. And I think you're really onto something with those negative emotions. But I would try and go one step more than that. And so I would think, where did it get so confusing? Because ultimately, food is something that we all need multiple times a day, 365 days a year, to stay alive. It is a basic human need. So at what point did it go from, you know, something as kind of as simple as that? And I know food plays so many more exciting and wonderful and enriching roles in our life, but just laying it bare, to something where an emotion like guilt comes up. Because when we break down guilt, guilt's doing wrong. It is the implication that a moral code has been violated. And, you know, sometimes I will say to my clients, you know, did you murder somebody to get the food? Because that implies that this moral code has been broken. And so what I would say is, perhaps it's not, I'd say those emotions, guilt, anxiety, shame, are part of disordered eating. But I would say diet culture, this culture that we live in that's telling us that food and eating is linked to morality, that we are good or bad, that is always telling us that we should be striving to look a certain way, to fulfill a certain aesthetic ideal, which is going to be unrealistic for 99% of the population. I would say we have to look to that as certainly, you know, one of the biggest kind of industries, if you like, or spaces that need, you know, that holds that blame. And, you know, I'd say particularly with eating disorders, that diet culture doesn't cause eating disorders. I know I'm moving between eating disorders and disordered eating, and I'm conscious that they're very different things.
Can you explain, just before you do that jump, just for people listening, the distinctions or your version? Because I know eating disorders is very kind of clear, whereas disordered eating is a little bit more open in terms of
the
way. Can you talk on your what an eating disorder is, and then disordered eating, and then we can kind of jump back in?
Yeah, absolutely. So I would say that eating would exist along a spectrum. So if you were to think about this line, we've got normal eating at one end, or we could call it intuitive eating. And at the other end, we've got an eating disorder. And in the middle, we might have disordered eating. Now, disordered eating would be where eating doesn't fit maybe social norms. So it doesn't fit like the social norms of eating. But there is distress with that. And that's the key. So for somebody, missing breakfast because they actually like to have, you know, lunch maybe at 11:30 might just be the way that they operate. And they have completely normal eating throughout the rest of the day, can answer their hunger, can make sure they get everything in, probably doing that without thinking too much about it. But when there's distress, i.e. I'm missing breakfast because I'm stressed or anxious if I do eat it, or, you know, there's all of those emotions arising, that's when we start thinking about it as disordered eating. Now, disordered eating is phenomenally common. It's the prevalence is crazy. And I don't know the statistic off the top of my head, but I would say most of us are experiencing now a degree of disordered eating. It becomes an eating disorder when it meets sort of these thresholds as laid out by a diagnostic manual called the DSM-5, which warrants a diagnosis for a clinical eating disorder. Now, obviously, disordered eating can then exist in different levels of sort of intensity or severity is the word I'm looking for. So you might have somebody with very severe disordered eating that's kind of on the cusp of a clinical eating disorder, or you might have somebody with sort of less severe disordered eating. And sometimes I think that those stringent criteria for clinical eating disorders are quite unhelpful, because what I like to say is, if you are experiencing any kind of distress, with eating, you know, food and eating or body image is the source of stress, anxiety, unhappiness, if it's kind of on your mind a lot of the time, then please, please, please reach out for support. Please know that you don't have to go through this, that there is other ways, and that you are so worthy and deserving of support, irrespective of whether anyone meets these stringent diagnostic criteria. And I would say the first point of call might be reaching out to the GP, somebody that you trust, reaching out to a helpline. It might be something like Samaritans or Mind or Beat. And just please know that support is there, and that food, it shouldn't be the source of stress. So just kind of segueing back, I think that's where we have to consider this diet culture that sort of morphed from Atkins and Slimming World into this diet mentality that we can't quite put our fingers on, sort of this state of being rather than something we are doing, which is why it's quite terrifying, that has a lot to answer for in, you know, making us conflate something as primal and as sort of life-giving, as nourishing our bodies, as meeting our body's basic need for fuel, and really turning that into something that is fraught with these challenging emotions.
I love that. One of the things that I connected with the most on your Instagram page is that you're putting out that message for people to improve that food relationship, get them to check in with their intuitive side when it comes to eating. And one of the things you mentioned there, Isabel, I'm definitely going to pull out for people that next time, because I know there's a lot of people listening, because I know my listenership very well at this stage, that have that guilt around food, that they'll eat a quote unquote bad food, and even though they know they shouldn't separate foods into good and bad, they'll still think, oh, they'll feel that guilt. And I think that's a really powerful tool that you mentioned, to ask yourself, did you murder somebody to get that food? Because otherwise you're feeling guilt around something, which means you need to kind of rewire your relationship with it, which is what I'm going to segue into now, Isabella, which is to follow your Instagram page, because I think you do this in such a great way, the way you put it across on your blog, because you break it down. Your Instagram is like chunks of your blog, which is a really effective way of delivering the message. And I just have one final question for you, because I've loved this conversation. I could literally listen to you talk about intuitive eating all day. But the last question I have for you, and as somebody that is putting out a very positive message, I know you're doing a lot of things in the background, you're working with lots of different people, you have a packed schedule, but just a side question that's either might be personal life, might be something in your business life, might be something in social media, but what are you most excited about right now?
That is such a good question. What am I most excited about right now? I have an idea that is in the pipeline, very, very early stages. So I am wanting to do something in this space that hopefully might reach more people and might be more accessible for offering support, because obviously my one-to-one client work, which I love, is, you know, only so many hours in the week and people I can reach. So really wanting to think about something that reaches more people in dismantling some of these messages and some of the stuff that diet culture has made us feel in relation to food. I have had one meeting on this said project, so I am not going to reveal too much more. But you know, I think right now, Brian, with everything that's going on and the uncertainty in everyday life, I am just really trying to look forward to the mundane things and try and make them like these sunshine or fairy-like moments in my week. So I am going out for dinner with some friends on Thursday, and I am so looking forward to that. And all of these sort of little things, whether it's sort of a morning coffee, without wishing to be a total cliche, or it's the slight kind of chill in the air in the morning, or it's, you know, a hot bubble bath after a day of work, that without being able to plan that much at the moment, that it's these little things that seem to be really enriching and joyful in the week. So yeah, I think really just looking to the little fairy lights and not the light bulbs at the moment.
I love that. The fairy lights and not the light bulbs. That's such a great line. Isabella, I have, as I mentioned, loved this conversation. I love the message you're promoting out there for people. I think anybody that falls along that line of disordered eating, I highly recommend they check out your blog, check out your Instagram page, and just fuel your mind with those ideas, because that's what's benefiting people. And that's what's, I think that's why your content is so valuable. So that's my call to action for people to go follow your stuff. But for everybody listening, Isabella, where is the best place for them to connect with you? Is it the website and Instagram, or is there anywhere else you'd like to send people?
Yeah, thank you so much, Brian. I've absolutely loved this conversation too. Best place to find me is my Instagram, which is at Isa, which is ISA Robinson _ nutrition, or exactly on my website, which is isarobinsonnutrition.co.uk.
Amazing. And for everybody listening, I will put those in the show notes for wherever you are listening to podcasts, and they'll be available on briankeenfitness.com. So you can click in there. Everything that we've mentioned in today's episode, the books, the resources, and everything Isabella's mentioned there will also be linked. Isa, thank you so much again.
Thanks, Brian.
There you have it. Nutritionist Isa Robinson on food addiction, managing disordered eating, and the problem with diet culture. Hopefully you got loads from today's episode. If you want to get my three major takeaways from today's episode, make sure you subscribe to my weekly newsletter. So just head over to briankeenfitness.com and pop your email into the newsletter on the bottom of the homepage. And every Thursday at lunchtime, I send you my top three takeaways that I've got from each episode. So this week's on Thursday is going to be everything I got from today's episode with Isa. As always, a massive thank you for listening. A thank you to today's sponsors, Clean Cut Meals. For those of you looking to save time with good, high quality, nutritious meals, definitely go check them out on cleancutmeals.ie. And that's everything from today's episode. Catch you all next week.